Hello and welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast for the week of the 23rd of April 2015. This is your weekly review of all things cycling. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, we keep an eye on the Ardennes, wrapping Sunday's Amstel Gold Race, Wednesday at La Flèche Wallonne, and preview the big one, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, as the Giro approaches. We pore over the form of Richie Porte as he tackles the Giro del Trentino. And considering the T-Dog will be away on Vacances for the next 6 weeks, we'll be speaking to Anthony about his career covering cycling to date. Should be absolutely engrossing. That's all in this week's show, and with me, as always, at least an increasingly regular guest, Ride Media's Rob Arnold. Rob, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Alex.
There is, and of course, the guy that we are going to be talking about later on, Anthony Tan. How are you, Tanny?
I'm well. I was thinking, I hope we have a segment on Phil, because Phil's like this enigmatic character. I think people are more interested in Phil than myself, but we'll see how it goes. If we get about 10 listeners this week, we'll know that my life is rather
The listeners will have spoken, speak.
So that was Anthony talking about the person who's not here, which is Phil Gomes.
Yeah, not here again.
Doing Flesh Alone last night, not actually riding it, watching it.
It would be good if he did.
Doing the things
he does. Have you ridden the Murder Hui?
I've walked it. Never had a bike when I've been there, unfortunately, but I have walked it and it hurts.
It even hurts walking down.
Actually, walking down is far more painful. Yeah.
People actually don't talk about walking down hills as difficult, but it's always reasonably difficult. I don't think your body's really meant to do that motion as much as it is.
There's a downhill marathon in Catalonia.
Is it?
Yeah.
40, what? The full 40
something? Well, I don't know if it's like designed to be downhill, but much of the course is downhill, and apparently it tears your legs to bits.
Interesting. Well, that's something for everyone to get out and go and do.
Yeah. If you're in the region of Hui, go for it.
Yeah. All right, guys, let's get into it. Lots to discuss, and we will start with the Ardennes. Well, last Sunday, Michel Kwiatkowski got the Omega ETX Quickstep, rather. Keep doing that. His first World Tour win of the year with a win at Amstel Gold, and he beat Alejandro Valverde and Australia's own Michael Matthews. Interesting little finish there, Tanny, and we'll talk about Amstel Gold first before we talk about the even more recent La Flèche Wallonne. But Amstel, you got the sense Gilbert was throwing everything at it. Michael Matthews on his wheel right up the Coburg, and then suddenly it sort of came back together. He ran out of steam, and we had a rather large group contest the finish together.
Yeah, I thought when Gilbert did his trademark attack, we knew he was going to do that because that's what he always done, and he's managed to win three times by doing that, two Amstels and one World Championship, so why wouldn't you do that? When I saw Bling go to his wheel, I thought, he's going to win Amstel Gold, I thought, in his second participation, because I thought, well, he's dug so deep to get on that wheel, and even when he's hurting, he will still have enough to beat Gilbert. Gilbert is reasonably quick in a sprint, but nothing like Bling. The Carlborg decided the group rather than the winner, and then Kwiatkowski's move, that sprint that I didn't realise he was so quick, Rob.
He's versatile, isn't he? He's just an unbelievable bike rider. And he looks fabulous. He's wearing a skin suit as he comes across the line. He's got the full-on world champion, you know, in the middle of the road. The shot is picture perfect for the sprinters, you know, but it's not a sprint. It's just a really good elite group of guys. You know, we look at Rui Costa in fourth place, and the rest of the top ten's just a shining example of who's going well at the moment. And I thought it was a riveting race, and especially the end. But to see guys like Dave Tanner and Simon Clark on the attack, that was cool. Taking on Tony Martin and the might of Vincenzo Nibali, you know, let's not let reputation get in the way of a good attack.
Mm.
That was fantastic.
I mean, I think one of the things that sort of happened potentially, you know, I mean, Gilbert, as you said, Tanny, he's done it many times before on that exact climb. But I feel like perhaps the presence of Matthews kind of made him double take a little bit when he would normally have totally committed, kept on riding, and maybe that would have been the winning gap, and then everyone would have been racing for second and there wouldn't have been the cooperation. But what ended up happening was Matthews was there. As you say, he knows that Matthews is probably faster than him in a bunch dash, even in that sort of sprint, and maybe just took his foot off the gas a little bit, and that conspired to, you know, destroy him.
Yeah, perhaps, because we've seen it happen with when someone is riding with Peter Sagan in a break and they hesitate, and then the group reforms and it becomes a big bunch sprint. So yeah, we did see him, you know, look over quite a few times. So I was just, yeah, there was the hesitation, and but that extra, what is it, 1.8 kilometers from the top of the Kahlberg to the finish.
Is it that far? No, it's from the. Is it really that
yeah,
far?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
That would have allowed a huge regrouping then.
Yeah.
So
and it obviously did, but I mean, it also, I think it increasingly is. It's changed the dynamic of the race a little bit, because that didn't used to be the runway, I think, at Armstrong Gold. It's only been there for the last few years, Tony.
Yeah, so you won't get a pure climber winning Armstrong. Like, for example, when you had, I remember one of the years I covered it, you know, you had Frank Schleck win, and you won't get a guy like that winning Armstrong unless he breaks away before. I mean, I said with one of the guys I mentioned in my sort of little preview is that, you know, in order for someone who doesn't have a fast finish to win, they need to do a Roman Kreuzinger thing when he won. But that's, I think, in 2011. But that scenario is like a 1 in 100.
And you saw little moves, I think, at Armstrong sort of trying to poke their way out before the climb.
Mm.
But it's so, I mean, you have to get that timing right. And the thing is, the peloton is just going full gas. So you get a little gap, and maybe you're 50 metres up the road before everyone just surges, and then you're swamped. I think there was a...
But it's great that they're animating the race.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned, Rob, Clark and Tan. I mean, who knows? They could have pulled something off. I was thinking we're going to get two Aussies. There was all these potential scenarios, and then... It felt like also, I'm glad the peloton sort of felt the same way I did when I rode around there, because you actually don't know where you're going. It is really the race of 1,000 turns. You just keep kind of looping back on yourself. That's how it feels anyway,
right? Particularly that last turn onto the actual final climb itself. I mean, that's a completely mental, you know, you got this massive bulging peloton wanting to be right at the base of that climb, and it's a hairpin, and it's quite narrow as well. I mean,
you saw how concentrated the riders have to be, you know, just in the two Ardennes races we've seen so far in Flesh, you know, yesterday, we just have to say, oh, far out. I think, you know, Rob and I were just saying before we got into the studio, just the number of crashes that we're seeing, and I'm not sure why you can explain them. You know, now we've got, you know, Tour de France champion of 2013, Chris Froome. I mean, he decides he's just coming off this massive training block in Tenerife, and and now he's stuffed his back up again. It looked like he looked really hurt, Rob.
I haven't seen the injury report, but he didn't look good. Yeah. But I think it's
they've watered it down a bit, I think, overnight. I think they released a statement saying that he's okay, but I mean,
but that's Flesh. We're going to talk about Flesh in a
We will.
Back to Amstel. I had a couple of thoughts about Amstel. I think it's the race that people are real coming to terms with still. Like, it's not got the Arenberg. It doesn't have La Redoute, like Liège-Bastogne-Liège. It doesn't have some particular climb that everyone understands, except for the Kahlberg. And we know that now well, especially because of the World Championships there in 2011. But the sequence of Gilbert is quite, it's not comical, but we did a thing years ago when he was probably even still with FDJ of a sequence of photos of him on the attack. You know, he's done it everywhere on the Cipressa, on what was the climb in Geelong, that on Chambalara or something. You know, he attacked there at the Worlds in 2010. He just does it time and time and time again. He would have done on the Mudahy in Flesh, but we'll talk about that, but he had a crash. You know, he's predictable, he's solid, he just is never says die. And people may be riding to their power meters, and this was the thought that came up earlier, but and they know what they're able to put out. But unless you roll the dice, you don't know. And it could have been that the Clark or Tanner move the other day did pay off, because there just might have been that moment's hesitation, or they might have been like, oh, I don't know about Dave Tanner. He might not have it in him. But he's proving time and again that he has got the pedigree to go on the attack. One day he'll finish it off soon. I'm sure that there's a win coming due for him.
I mean, you know, like so much of cycling is mental, and we talk about that a lot. But right. I mean, you know,
when just that hesitation that can prompt.
Mm. When Gilbert's away, okay, you're looking at your power meter and you're going, oh, can he hold that? All you need is that to just go and, you know, to conspire to totally undo you. And that's Gilbert, you know, getting that winning gap.
But, exactly.
It didn't obviously in this occasion.
Like, I remember a few years ago being in the car with Matt White, and I referenced that I've been in the car with him a bit, but it was Thomas De Gendt was on the attack in the Tour Down Under. And he was like, just keep an eye on this one. You know, that was before he was on the podium at the Giro. And he was one of those guys who was sort of who is he again? And there's going to be a few more of those coming through, filtering through. You know, maybe Dave Tanner is one. I don't know. I'm just referencing it for the sake of Amstel Gold commentary. But there seems a lot of, yeah.
You guys referenced Simon Clark. And I know, you know, he's popped his head up and he did quite a good ride. But he's, I suppose, just to play devil's advocate, he's a funny little rider in some ways, because he had that sort of almost meteoric 2012, was it now? It's a little while ago now in the memory in terms of his performance at the Vuelta.
Mm.
I don't know. He's in a funny place in some
class.
Ways.
I think he's fabulous. You know, he won the Sun Tour a couple of years ago, and but he was also King of the Mountains at the Vuelta after that stage win, and he never really meant to be going for the polka dot jersey, and suddenly it became a challenge for him, and I think he quite liked going back to the podium, so he really chased it. And that's indicative of what he's like. I ask him to classify himself, and he always jokes about it, saying, well, if you call me a climber, I'm going to go and try and win a sprint, you know, for example. And he almost did at the Cadel Evans road race earlier
but
this year.
But in some ways his versatility is very good, but you wonder whether he's sort of one of those classic Australian riders where he's sort of jack of all, master of none.
I remember I first met Simon after he'd done a Madison with Matt Goss as a junior, and, you know, and he presented as a track rider.
Mm.
I mean, and then you see him on the telly and he looks very small, but he's an everything man. He can do a lot of different, he's a very versatile guy, and he's a really good teammate. If they put him on a roll, he seems to fill that objective very well.
I suppose just whether he's going to elevate himself to a point beyond that, it seems at the moment I feel like when he was riding with ISD back in the day, you know, he was winning races, he was doing quite good classics rides. And I know that he's playing a different role at Green Edge, certainly. I mean, you saw that he was basically setting it up for Matthews at Amstel, for example. He's setting up for Albasini at Flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, did I get that wrong? But whether he's sort of, he's going to jump onto that next level, I don't know. Tanya, I mean, what do you think?
I felt that, you know, in Guerin's absence, he should have put his hand up, and perhaps he plays the team role, as Rob said, very well, and that almost leads one to think, well, is Matt White and Shane Banner thinking, well, he plays it so well, then
we should keep him in his place.
keep him there, and then I mean, these moves that he's doing, he's doing it for someone else, even though it looks like it potentially may have got away. But if you're in a leadership role, you're protected right until the end. So I'd like to see him as a protected rider a bit more, to see what he can do rather than simply assuming this almost like a super Domestique's role in the Ardennes races. Yeah.
At the in Mendrisio at the World Championships in 2009, he played a big role in Cadel winning. And a lot of people, he was just a kid back then. You know, I like the story of Simon Clark. I could talk about him for a long time. He came to cycling because his father took him on the Great Victorian Bike Ride, and then he just realised that he quite liked it. And I think that, for me, that resonates. I just love the idea of someone not really knowing much about cycling, and then now he's a professional because he did a community ride.
As opposed to Bradley Wiggins, who sort of knows everything about cycling, seems to be a little embittered by that experience.
Anyway, we got off on a Clark tangent there, but do we talk about that sprint of Kwiatkowski's? Because it was fantastic. Like, you know, Amstel Gold, watch the finish. The last kilometre will really tell a great story. It's riveting stuff.
It's a good finish. It's one of those ones where you don't know at any point who's going
to
win.
To see Matthews follow Gilbert, basically die a thousand deaths, you knew that he was in absolute pain. Mm. And then his brake gets caught, and then he still sprints to third. You chastised me last week for talking a lot about Michael Matthews. I'm going to keep talking about Michael Matthews. He's a superstar.
I tipped Michael Matthews at Amstel, so I just chastise you for fun, Rob. You know that.
Well, chastise. You said stop talking about Michael Matthews. We're not going to stop talking about Michael Matthews for a while.
I know.
The Giro's coming up. Is he doing the Giro? What's the plan? I think it's Giro and Tour.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe 2 weeks of the
I'm
Giro.
Is he doing the Giro?
I haven't.
I think so.
Gerrans is doing the Giro.
Yeah, they haven't really. Have they announced their roster?
I think, recently announced their roster.
That might be next week's discussion, hey?
Yeah.
And then I can talk about Michael Matthews again.
Anyway, Rob, sorry to cut you off in segues about Clark and all that, but Flesh Willon.
Are we moving right along?
We are going to keep moving along to keep the momentum going. Alejandro Valverde pulled out sort of just a very Alejandro Valverde sprint at the top of the moor.
Yes.
The race, I mean, you say it was very...
There's no music. We're just going straight from
one race
to the next.
No, we're
going to
do all the Ardennes in one go, Rob.
All right. I was waiting for the music. Sorry, I'm confused now.
Yeah. defined very much by the crashes, I think, because in the end, that final time up the climb, it almost felt like it was neutralised. I know they're going full gas, but it was like, we're all sort of hurting. And then usually you'd see a guy, I think maybe last year, you know, someone jump away, a Betancourt or something like that. I think Betancourt did do a little poke, and then that sort of animates it all and starts. But what really happened was Valverde was quite happy to see them all go up there together. Albasini was sort of looking good, and then it was almost fait accompli.
Yeah, it was. We said yesterday, or on the eve of the race, that Valverde should win. That was the talk about Flesh Willon in our office, and that was pretty much the end of the commentary. And he was the bookies' favourite.
He was everyone's every pundit's favourite. I mean, you pretty much had to not be following cycling to say he wasn't the favourite. I felt. You saw, if we just compare the intensity of the finale of Amstel versus Flesh.
Amstel had it all over Flesh.
Yeah, the Flesh was just, people were just worried about crashing, but with Amstel you felt they had really ridden such a hard race, and you just saw it every time they're kicking out of the corners in Amstel, those narrow roads. I mean, it was just so, that's what I meant about, they just had to be so fully concentrated the whole time, whereas Flesh, I was bored actually.
I mean,
let's go over it. So Philippe Gilbert crashed at what, 56k to go or something. Froome was caught. Well, Pools was caught underneath Anthony Roux from FDJ for a long time in the ditch with what, 20 or 30 kilometers to go. There were just crashes after crashes. When I was watching, I was just thinking, this is just a bit weird. Like, I just found. This huge investment in guys like Froome, and it can all just fall. I mean, it's just cycling commentary. That's what we know. It's not. I'm spelling out the obvious, but I was shocked by it last night.
I think for me, the funny thing about Flesh just as a race is it sits kind of as this afterthought between Amstel and Liège, as you know, Amstel being the opening Ardennes, and I know it does, it's got you. Tanny, we sort of mentioned that it almost doesn't have these defining climbs, but it does have a bit of its own flavour in the way it sort of plays out. Flesh, I know it goes over the moor a few times, but the actual race itself often feels quite stale in the sense that we almost never get a change in the way it plays out.
Mm.
You know, it almost always ends with, other than that classic
1994.
The Ferrari year. It was amazing that he was able to elevate three guys to the podium. Amazing stuff. But really what tends to happen is you get a big group of riders who contest the sprint together. One guy is a bit more powerful, times it perfectly.
Mm.
But you also get the sense that a lot of guys have an eye on Liège. You know,
It used to be the weekend. It was the Ardennes weekend, and it was Flesh on Saturday as a warm-up, a prelude to Liège, which is like, much like a, well, it's a mini stage race, really, and over...
That was worse. That was worse. I mean, because that's...
That was a long time ago, but...
Yeah.
It's been on the Wednesday for ages now, but it was, imagine the Flesh on the Saturday, Liège on the Sunday. You're going to have to be strong
as an ox. That's almost... That's 470 kilometres of racing in 2 days.
In the hills. Amazing.
Yeah.
But anyway, what was your question again?
It wasn't a question. I was just saying that it's in a funny space. I mean, I don't think anyone would probably suggest otherwise. It just it feels always like we're waiting for Liège rather than Flesh being. I know that, you know, obviously Evans won that big year, and, you know, we sort of look at it and go, oh, what a good race. But
I find it it's
always feels kind of underwhelming.
It is an awkward moment in the calendar because there is. From January through till Roubaix, for example, there's full on anticipation. You understand the sequence pretty well. You know, even starting Tour Down Under, everyone loves it because it's the first, so there's great, you know, new colours and this and that. And then there's Oman and the desert races. And then, you know, it's the sequence of the classics, which we all become so familiar with. And I feel like after Roubaix, there's sort of almost a collective sigh. And then you're like, okay, the classics guys are gone now. Let's watch the GC guys come. And Flesh is almost a prelude to me for Tour of Romandie and the Giro. You know, that we'll blink our eyes and the Giro have begun.
Oh, totally. And we'll talk about some of that in a second. Valverde, he was a very gracious winner. I think he, in Alistair Fotheringham's piece, he said, buenas tardes to everyone before the press. He's always... He's generally pretty good at press conferences unless he's asked about certain subjects. But anyway, in my experience, which is not potentially as much as yours, Tan, he's always been very open to the media in his exchanges and always willing to talk about things. Contador to an extent as well, actually. They're both like that.
Yeah. They don't give much short shrift. I mean, I can't speak Spanish, so most of the times I've ask questions to Valverde, being through an interpreter. So, but I've noticed that he does look at you when he answers you. So I don't mind the guy. And then you have to admire whatever you think his past and whatever, you know, in terms of his ability to stay competitive throughout the season. It reminds me a little bit of Zabel. In that, you know, he was competitive throughout the season, and I'm not sure whether, you know, is he the last of that breed who still care about
the prestige of lots of these races?
Yeah, racing throughout the season and winning throughout
the season. I think Rodriguez is probably in the same vein. You know, he's always been a guy that seems evergreen throughout the year, and he was up there as well. He was fourth. Yeah. You know, he's a guy that loves that sort of race as well, a bit of punch in him. And but... Anyway, I mean...
Yeah, but it is a long time since 2003 when Valverde burst onto the scene and got his world championship medal in the road race. You know, that was... It's 2003. That was a bloody long time ago, and he's been winning consistently ever since.
Mm.
He's phenomenal. And he's, what, 35 or 36?
Yeah.
And he does it... When you see him at the front of the Muda Heat, normally if they're sort of a little bit ageing, you start thinking, oh... When's he going to falter? But with Valverde, you're just looking at him thinking he's on top of his gear, he's on top of his game, he's ready to go. And it looked to me like he had a couple of little surges there yesterday on the Muda Heat, and then he got the one that mattered as well.
But perfectly plays as well. I mean, let's not take any credit away from him, because Visconti did a fantastic job in just placing him at the front, which is really, if you are at the front of at the bottom of the Moor, you have a very good chance of, or not necessarily right at the front, but if you're in that front sort of 15, it's almost always decided by that point. If you're too far back, you're not surging back.
You probably need to be in the front 10, Al. Like I've noticed that even if you're even 15 back, which Kwiatkowski was,
you saw him, didn't you?
You just can't move up. It's not a climb where you can move up.
It's narrow, it's steep, and the way it twists, you sort of can't ever naturally overtake without really doing an effort. And then if you've done that effort, you're done, because the climb itself is so unforgiving.
Yeah, it almost, that last 200, 300 metres to the line, it looks like it's in slow motion almost, because Absolutely. The guys are just that knackered and there's nothing, it's kind of, well, he, you know, it's he with whatever they've got left.
And there's a little segue, but we're still talking about Mudahi, but Rabo Live certainly know how to win there, don't they? Like, they've had three in a row, is it?
I think so.
For the women's flesh, which finishes when the guys have got about 80k to go. But at least we got a little grab of the highlights of that yesterday. Not very much.
Where there are occasions where this is possible, I mean, this is the thing they should be doing. I mean, like, what does it really matter to see 80k's to go of, you know, the men's race in a race like Flesh, which we've just talked about, is so often decided by the more. I mean, wouldn't it be great?
Like, just instead of just watching the little highlights of what's the winner's name?
Was it Van der Breggen this year?
Yeah. And you literally saw the last corner, the stationary camera they
and
showed.
And it wasn't even live because down the bottom of the screen it said... They're trying to do incorporate English, but in this case it was said bientôt l'arrivée flesh alone féminine. So I thought, oh, okay, they're going to show the live, but it was just a replay. And then I did happen to be flicking between SBS and Eurosport. I noticed Eurosport commentator pretty much said, oh, well, this is how it was won.
Okay,
so right. I was waiting for the live, and then it was
but they
a replay.
Could have shown 10 kilometers of it.
Yeah. Well, exactly, that's what I mean.
Exactly.
You know, like
just that lead up at the penultimate climb, and the anticipation of. But I think it was a full on. My understanding, it was a full on escape, wasn't it? That won the women's flesh.
This is why you need to see parts of it.
We only got a snapshot of this.
There's something
tiny bit,
called picture in picture. You know, they've been doing that for years. Mm. I just don't see why.
Keep the men's race in the top corner. Yeah. Switch the women's for. I mean, the cameras are literally there. They're on course. The satellite time is already purchased.
Mm.
There are literally so many overlaps. I mean, this isn't a case where the race is. You know, they have to extend the broadcast time and they have to buy more. This is literally at the same time. I think the same could be said for Women's Flanders as well, you know, and that was, you know, I know, again, we did see some bits, but all those sort of races where there's overlap, and I think Rochelle Gilmore has talked about this to no end, you know, where the infrastructure is there, let's use it. I mean, it makes total sense.
I guess I've put myself in a trap because I started talking about something that I didn't really get to see. And it's hard to commentate on something that you don't really understand.
Well, I mean, broadly speaking, Rob, I mean, you know, this is something that we could talk... I mean, we has been talked about a lot.
We've covered it well, but, it's just worth referencing that Rabo Live just smashed that.
They're kind of a bit like the super team of the women's peloton, aren't they? I mean, I know that a lot of people talk about Wiggle Honda, but really, Rabo Live,
they're like the Mapei. Women's Mapei.
Well, I think going to last year's Worlds, they were like, you know, they had, I don't know, something like five of the top eight positions on the world rankings. It was something absurd, you know. Yeah, it's right. Like, you know, Rabo Live first and Daylight second, third and fourth, and then maybe we'll talk about some other teams. Mm-hmm. Anyway, guys, one final thing before we finish talking about the Ardennes, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which is on this Sunday. Obviously, Simon Gerrans took the big one last year and it was a massive victory for Australia, but I don't think Gerrans will be the guy for Green Edge on Sunday. He's certainly not shown the form to be up there. But Valverde, Gilbert, Rodriguez, Dan Martin has talked himself up. I mean, who
pulls out? I mean, who overcomes their injuries, for example?
I know, because Martin, Gilbert... Froome dog, they all crashed.
I've got to start practicing Julian Alaphilippe's name because like he came second yesterday in Flesh, and I was surprised to even read that he was French this morning. I thought he was a Colombian. I don't know why, but that's just you know.
He was Belgian.
Well, anyway,
he writes.
I don't know why I thought he was Colombian. Only just
that could be Colombian. Could it? Julian? That's kind of a bit of a.
And then Julian's also a Belgian name, common name in Belgium.
But he's only 22. He's obviously
I just made that up. Actually,
he's destined to be a superstar. He's another guy.
We'll talk about that part of Anthony Tan's career a bit later. But
this is Rob stuff up since 1989.
Yeah, that's right. But no. This is Rob. You know, this is a race that you've been covering for a long time. Give us a sense of how A, historic and B, significant it is to win it, because it's been around forever.
Yeah, it's the old girl, isn't it? The oldest of them all, but it hasn't had the most editions. So there was a big long stop pause for a while. But my memory of it, I went over in 2006 and I watched the Valverde double in Flesh Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And I did a large part of in the lead up to Liège, I did a reconnaissance in the car with Alan Piper following Cadell and Chris Horner and all the guys from the Davidamon Lotto team. And so I got to understand the course a lot better then. I always romanticised about it. I thought it was a really beautiful race. And the scenery that it covers is gorgeous all through the Ardennes there. And there's some fantastic climbs. The finish is woefully industrial and ugly. It's set up in a Pizza Hut car park.
A lot of people don't realise that Liège is a pretty dull town.
Well, the finish is in...
Ons.
In Ons, exactly. Yeah. But the finish... So I guess I went sort of expecting that it would be glorious, and it was for the reconnaissance, but at the finish, when you're sitting in the zone technique at the finish, you're just thinking, get me out of here. I wish I was out on the course. So if you go to Liège, go to La Redoute or do something cool with about 40K to go, there's plenty of good climbs, but it's just that the finish is not so pretty. Mm. I don't know if I'm overviewing the race the way that you'd like it to.
No, but just in terms of the guys that win here, I mean, it's a very hard race, 250 kilometres.
It was a good dopers race. It really pulled the dopers to the fore for a long time.
Well, because the climbs were so hard and it was so long, you basically had to be on the...
Well, when Hamilton won, for example, it was amazing to watch, but it was just ridiculous to watch, especially with hindsight and what is confirmed as being true. Mm. But now it's a little bit... It can have that intrigue, and we've seen little clusters of people come to the finish. Like Dan Martin was alongside, who was he with?
Rodriguez. Caruso. Caruso was it?
Yeah.
Who won the year Martin crashed? Are you talking with the year?
Wasn't that Garrett? No. When Martin won 2 years.
When Martin won, I think it was Caruso. He was with Caruso and then dropped him.
So they're coming to the finish now with a little selection. 10 guys or so. That was how it was when Valverde won in 2006, and I still remember that finish pretty well but. I don't know. Liège. I like it. I look forward to it. But it doesn't hold that anticipation that Flanders, Roubaix, Milan San Remo
does. No, it doesn't, which is interesting, I think. Tony?
I get pretty psyched with Liège. I mean, I covered it in 2006. I spent a whole season in Europe. And, just being at the start in the Place de Saint-Lambert, like at the start just interviewing the riders, I mean, you can't help but get it. They're brimming, with nervous tension. You can just feel it, that, they're in for a huge day, physically, mentally. You just know when they make that turnaround and then they head back. It's so hard for them, and they're just trying to save all their energy. They don't want to say too much because they need all that energy on the way back. And there's an unpredictability to Liège that more so than Armstrong and Flesh, I think, and that's what for me. And then it's also that history as well.
Mm.
It's perhaps the only race where we might see a Tour de France champion win Liège and the Tour.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. All right, guys, we'll leave it there for the Ardennes. I think we've covered them pretty comprehensively, and let's talk about something else, which will be the Giro del Trentino. Thank you, Harry. Well, Richie Port won stage two of the Giro del Trentino overnight. That was Wednesday, rather, at the Parco del Baldo stage, and put himself in the leader's jersey. He's just come out of a block of altitude training and obviously is preparing himself for the Giro d'Italia. But very good signs for the Australian, just weeks out from that rollout. Guys, Trentino, obviously, Cadel Evans won last year. Obviously, we don't want to keep any of our listeners who are not Australian, make it sound like we're too jingoistic, but...
We're in Australia.
We are in Australia. We are all Australian. SBS we have an Australian disclaimer.
Yes. I saw the results, but first thing I saw was that picture on Cycling News, and you just saw Richie, and he looked very, very lean. I mean, just seeing the veins through his arms, and I just
the Sky jersey looked good, didn't it?
Yeah, I just thought this is a guy. The way he's presented himself this year is that we haven't seen before. He's just so serious and so singularly focused. And but now there's this conundrum. I think if Froome has hurt himself and he's not fighting fit for the tour, I think this will be a make or break decision by Sky, because if Sky say, look, we want you to ride as leader for the tour, and he bombs out because he's just been preparing all year to hit his straps at the Giro, then that will be, I think, reason enough.
They're not going to do that. They surely...
No, but as we referenced, this is an Australian podcast, so we can always hold hope that Richie gets a crack at the tour as well.
Well, he's certainly going to the tour. I think that's already been confirmed.
There's a few weeks to go, but
Sky have a history of pulling riders out of big races. At the 11th hour.
Well, that's true. I think this one, the way his season is built, I think even he'll be much more enthusiastic about going to the Giro. I think he would. If they even said to him, would you want to pull out and look at the tour, I think he would probably perhaps even
He's got it in his mind that the Giro, like he's got, he finished with goosebumps on goosebumps yesterday when he won the stage. But the attack lasted a long time. We got to see a lot of footage of him riding in the big gear. And there was obviously a climb, but he was smashing it and just burying himself. And he just looks totally on top of his form. To watch someone hold his gear so well, just riding like he does, it was a time trial on a road bike. It was really wonderful to watch.
He's looked this season probably without peer. You know, I mean, there's been really very few points where you'd say he's looked weak.
Yeah, he's got an elegant pedaling style, and it was nice to actually just see him on his own there. You know, when he won in Paris-Nice, it was a last minute attack, and Geraint Thomas was with him. But when Richie was riding in Trentino for stage two, you got a big long bout of footage of him on his own. And pulling away from the troops, you know, that was Michael Landa or someone from Astana chasing him down. And it was, he just seemed to be in a league of his own, like you just said. So I think come Giro time, it's going to be really interesting. Hopefully the other guys aren't just shadow boxing.
Importantly as well, and this is something we've mentioned a few times this year, but, you know, if you look at the GC at Trentino, it's not just Port doing well. You know, Leopold Koenig, who had a fantastic last year, he was right up there. David Lopez and Svitsov, you know, the old man of, well, not really that old, but the Belarusian who seems to have been around for a long time. The Sky is looking in very, very good shape. They are going to the Giro. I think that is basically the skeleton of the team. So Richie, it's not just Richie either, which I suppose is what I'm trying to say. The whole team is looking very strong, which is what you need to win a Grand Tour.
Yeah. I mean, that was always my concern. It was not Richie himself, but the support and the type of team that Sky would send to prosecute that objective. This is a bit tongue in cheek, but I just want to pull Richie up for something he said. I saw this. I'm glad you included it, Al. The effort the team put in was really the cherry on the icing on the cake. So it's almost like the Abbottism where he said, you know, dead, buried and cremated. I think what the effort the team put in was the icing, and he put the cherry on the top. Anyway.
I saw a quote, which I think is worth including as well, and that is I like winning bike races more than drinking beer. I think that's very poignant.
He said that.
Yeah. What a great quote.
Yeah. That
because,
is good.
You know, in other words, it's not to say that he was out on the town, you know, sinking the cans day after day, but he's understood that that sacrifice isn't a big sacrifice because he much prefers doing what he does than.
Well, I mean, I remember the 2012 national championships in Ballarat. I think it was 2012, maybe. I think it was 2012.
Oh, back in the day.
But Richie was in the Ballarat Hotel and we were sort of walking past, and I think Christy Johnson spotted Tomo and I. Tomo, come in.
That's Richie's former team manager.
Yeah, yeah.
He's referring to.
He was riding for Sky at this time, obviously.
Yeah, no.
But they go into their camps during that part of the year. But Richie was like downing the wines, and I know that's early in the season, but I didn't get the sense from him the years after that he was quite so loose with his alcohol. But I think it's a marked change, probably as he's matured, that he's sort of moved away from some of his vices.
Let's be clear. Like, every time I've spoken to him this year, he just keeps reminding me, look, I'm engaged, I'm super happy. I think that early end to his season last year has served him incredibly well. He's come into this, to 2015, fresh, motivated, excited. He copped a bit of a, not a, a bollocking, but they had a good old sit down at the end of last year and said, come on, Richie, it's time. Let's make this year your year. Mate, if he wins the Giro, we're going to be doing cartwheels in Australia because we...
Can you do a cartwheel, Rob?
Really badly. Did one on the sand the other day with my kids. They laughed at me, scoffed at me.
Some people at least will be doing cartwheels.
I'll do a forward roll.
Maybe a metaphorical cartwheel.
Figurative
cartwheel.
Look, I think we'll be particularly enthralled by what's to come in May. And I think the Giro finishes on 1st of June. But the rest of that, the preceding month's going to be a lot of late nights for cycling fans in Australia.
All right, we'll leave it there for Richie Porte and the Giro because I'm sure we will be talking about it plenty in that period, except for Tanny, who we're in the US. But we're going to talk about that just after this. Well, we're running out of time, but I do want to have a quick chat with Anthony Tan. We don't really, I think, illustrate who the people are behind, the background behind some of the personalities of this podcast and probably even SBS in general. I think a lot of people see Tomo, for example, on television and feel like they know him, but maybe don't know anything about him.
I don't know much about Tomo.
Enigmatic character that he is. Although then again, I think with Tomo, what you see is what you get. But we won't talk
really?
About
it. Okay. Continue.
Tanny, you're about to head off, so you won't be on the podcast for a few weeks, probably 6 weeks, is that right?
Probably seven.
Seven.
Yeah.
So we're gonna miss you around here. Yeah. Listeners may not. Well, it'll be interesting to see how the listening numbers spike or not.
Sometimes the podcast goes into a hiatus during Grand Tours, like the tour every year.
Yeah, because that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, during the time when we can attract most audience numbers, we go off.
We go off, yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Anthony's trying to get you to talk about you.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the plan of this segment, is that right?
I'm just trying to deflect.
Alex is, yes. Tanny... Maybe we'll start from the beginning for people that don't know anything about you. But what even got you into riding? When did you start riding a bike? Because people probably don't necessarily know that you do.
A road bike? Yeah, I know. I still get a lot of people saying, oh, you probably never ridden a road bike before. But I was there Tour Down Under. I had a little comeback. It's getting a bit cold now, so I've gone into hibernation. No, I was roommates with the brother of... Matt Bizzano, when I studied economics at Wollongong University, his name was Daniel, and his brother Matt was the Australian road champion, won the Commonwealth Bank Cycle Classic. Yeah, he always brought some bikes with him. He was always out riding, and then one weekend I said, "Oh, can I have a ride?" And I just rode from the Gong to Thurl or something like that. It wasn't very far. And that really captured me. I never had a racer before, just BMXs and stuff like that. So, yeah, just being in that contrived environment, the university environment, less contrived than a high school, but still it felt contrived, just studying commerce and stuff like that. This was an outlet for me, and that, I expressed it through cycling.
Mm. And then you rode, quite competitively. Probably people don't even know that. You started racing, and you spent some time in Europe as well.
Yeah, so I spent a couple of years, because I started uni like maybe 1 year younger than most people, are the average 17. So I had a couple of years as a under 19 before it went to seniors. So I did, had my experience with racing juniors, then opens and things like that. And then, I just had this far fetched idea that I could make it in Europe, and I was quickly disappointed to learn that I didn't finish my first, I think, 12 races in Holland, because they were criteriums, and over here criteriums are about an hour long or 45 minutes, and over there they're about 120 to 140 kilometers. You know, that's for amateurs, and you know, sometimes you're up against the junior Rabobank development team who you realize when they lap you and they're a couple about 4 years younger that you're probably not in the right profession.
So then you thought, I mean, I know you sort of hung around Europe for a little while, but you did eventually throw it in and come back. So what? Why journalism? Why the media?
Oh well, I did love cycling. I just wasn't suited to becoming a professional. I mean, I did some testing at the Mapei Centre in Milan, where Mick Rogers and all those guys have been tested.
You tested yourself?
No. Max Tester. I was hooked up with him, and he went through the whole rigmarole of
what
doing
year was all that.
1999, I think it was. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So
I
went to
Cast. How did you stumble on that? Because you were.
I did one season in Belgium and Holland. Then I did another season in Italy. I happened to be living with a guy who was very good friends with Andy Hampston, the Giro winner from 88. He suggested that he goes, oh, you know, don't keep riding yourself, putting yourself down. You know, let's see if, you know, Andy can hook you up with his former trainer, who is Dr. Max Tester, who's now the doctor for BMC. He did a whole lot of tests on me. He said, yeah, you know, you've got a decent motor. You just need to lose about 6 or 7 kilograms. And I took that to mean...
At this point, you'd already been slogging yourself.
At that point, I'd already mentally checked out. I actually went to the Greek islands and holidayed and partied, you know, a la Richie Port for about 7 weeks. And I never went back.
To bring us back to where we were, but, you know, when you started media, what was the reasoning to go into that?
Well, I said, I love this sport. How can I stay in it? And the only way was really, as a soigneur, no, because I don't really want to keep touching their legs all day. And, you know, it looked like hard work. And so I thought, I had some ability to string a sentence together through my previous career in advertising as a copywriter. And I just studied journalism at night school. I had to do it surreptitiously, you know, couldn't tell anyone, otherwise I'd get fired from my day job. And then started working at Cycling News, and that was in 2001.
So it's been a long road. Tony, Cycling News obviously was a very different sort of organisation to what it is now, which is the premier, I mean, maybe it was the premier place, but it was certainly a lot smaller as an organisation. What about, I mean, we don't have a lot of time to go through the whole thing, but what about your time in that 12-year period covering cycling? I mean, just what's, obviously a lot's changed, but what do you think have been the biggest changes in that period?
Yeah, so, well, 2001
from a journalism
to 14, I would say everything has to be so much more immediate. Even though I started off working in the web in cycling, now it's you just got to get it up as soon. So you had to get it up as quickly as possible. Now it really matters, because then there was maybe you could go to Cycling News, Velo News, some of these Dutch results websites. But now it's just the proliferation of websites, and particularly, and then if we look at cycling websites, it's crazy now. And I think, you know, there's been this almost like survival of the fittest, and now Velo News aren't concentrating trying to go head to head so much with Cycling News, because you just can't compete. You know, Cycling News had that sort of first mover advantage, and now, but you know, I think now it's a way I look at it now. I'm not in sales, but now I think, well, how do you monetize the web to the extent that you can make it a viable business proposition? And I think that's what a lot of websites are facing, this conundrum. But I know now, yeah, you're just expected to turn out content so quickly, you know, maybe with...
Which is in an erosion of quality.
Yeah, you had 2 or 3 days sometimes to work on just a story. Now you've got half a day. So And then, sometimes I had 3 months to work on, say, an investigative piece on why, people, the winner of the Tour de Langkawi didn't get his prize money, Ryan Cox, 1 year. Sadly, he passed away. But the thing was, all that sort of stuff takes time. And, we don't obviously, as you know, we don't have the resources of Four Corners.
No, not quite. We're, very close. I mean, the studio itself is gold-plated for those people that can't see it. And Rob's on a huge stipend just to be here. So, we do our best.
I don't know what he's talking about. I paid my own parking. Yeah. I take an hour out of my day. Yeah. I come and I do the slog.
Tony, we might have to leave it there because we don't have much time, but... we might have to pick this up again at some other point and grab your thoughts on some other things. But
have a rad holiday.
Yeah, have.
Thank you.
New York.
Yeah, I've never taken a holiday during the cycling season. Well, since 2001. So it will be interesting to see if there is work forthcoming in terms of a job when I return.
So sobering. Just a reminder quickly as well to everyone, we do have Liège-Bastogne-Liège this Sunday. I know I've said that a few times, but we basically don't have a podcast without the broadcast of these big events. And
sit up and hashtag SBS Cycling and have a bit of fun with the community. Yeah, talk to one another.
And give us feedback as much on the podcast as we can. We're trying to make it as good as we can for you as always. And thanks always to those who actually listen and do comment, because it keeps us going. Guys, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a long one.
It has been a long one, but a lot to cover. Tanny, bon voyage.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
We'll see you when you're back. Guys, thank you again. We will be planning on doing more pods for the duration of the Giro d'Italia. And to everyone again, we'll see you next week. That's it. Bye for now.